Public Radio News at 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Through his books and documentary films, Dayton Duncan has tried to tell those stories that are uniquely American. He's the author of 10 books on topics that range from New Hampshire's first-in-the-nation primary to America's most sparsely settled counties to the story of Lewis and Clark. He's been a reporter for the Keene Sentinel, as well as chief of staff for New Hampshire Governor Hugh Gallon. But Dayton Duncan is probably best known for his collaborations with Granite State filmmaker Ken Burns. Together, the two have tried to show the full story of America, from its shining moments to its flawed heroes. Their multi-hour documentary series have covered topics ranging from Mark Twain to the Civil War to jazz and baseball, national parks, and Lewis and Clark. The teamwork of Burns and Duncan has been compared to that of those two westward explorers, Burns, the slightly younger, more daring and artistic Meriwether Lewis, and Duncan, the older, steadier, and focused William Clark. Before Ken Burns gives the nuance of light, camera angles, and thematic music to these films, it's Dayton Duncan who many times chooses the topic, does the research, and many of the interviews to find the stories behind the story. On Friday, Dayton Duncan joined me for a live event at the Colonial Theater in Keene. We talked about his work, his many collaborations with Ken Burns, and what he suggests makes a story uniquely American. Today in The Exchange, we bring you part of that performance. Thanks, everyone, for turning out, and of course to Dayton Duncan for being with us. And Dayton, it's great to see you, and it's great to see your name in lights out front on the marquee here at the Colonial Theater.
Well, thank you. And I want to welcome you back to the beautiful Monadnock region, the home of the second most climbed mountain in the world, and congratulate you on your 15 years of what a great program you have. I listen to it. I'm sure everyone here in the audience does. And you're an inspiration to your as an alum of Keene High School, you're an inspiration to all the blackbirds and ladybirds in Keene today.
Well, Dayton, thanks for being here again. And just to kick it off, you know, there's a whole universe of subjects that you and Ken Burns could choose for these wonderful films, but you always say we're trying to pick topics that are uniquely American. So what makes something uniquely American?
It can't be European. Or African or Asian or South American. So that narrows it down right at the start. Well, I don't think we know that yet. I mean, I think that's what animates the films that we do. As Ken likes to say, we're searching for the answer to a simple yet elusive question of who are we as Americans? You know, nonetheless, I think that we, through the course of many of the films that we've done, certain things stand out of how we became who we are, and that's what we're interested in is not a psychoanalysis, but of an exploration of history that lets us know how we got to the point that we are now, with the hope that the more we know about how we got here, the better armed we are to create a better future. So we're suckers for, I'm particularly a sucker for anything that deals with the geographical space of the United States and how that informed who we are, how we crossed it when we did a big film on the West. That was an important thing of determining who we are as a nation and also determining that we would be a continental nation, as Lewis and Clark did as well, the first American citizens to cross this continent and sort of the harbinger of the nation that would eventually cross that continent and claim it for itself. So that's part of who we are. Ken and I became friends because we realized that both of us had the habit of, much to sometimes the eye-rolling dismay of our children, of reading the Declaration of Independence aloud on the 4th of July every year. And we don't do it anymore. We call each other to make sure that each of us has done it, but but our kids don't have us do that anymore. So we are a nation that's also founded on an idea, that all men, all human beings are created equal. And that thought, that we have these inalienable rights, that quest is as important to who we are as Americans as the continent itself, and a quest that is not yet fulfilled. And so we're always interested in those things that that look into that of what is equality and what is freedom, what is the pursuit of happiness, what do those things mean, how does that animate who we are. And, of course, race. Race, both in terms of African Americans and in terms of Native Americans, is also central to who we think. To understanding our past, because you bump into it regardless of the topic that you choose. It's always, always, always there.
It does come up in your films all the time, and you're right, it's always there. Can you give us an example, Dayton, where you didn't expect it to be such an important part of the story, and it ended up being part of the story?
Well, I don't think I was a consultant and not the writer of baseball, but you would normally think that the story of America's pastime would not end up focusing as heavily as that series did on the issue of race, where here was, quote, America's pastime, and for a while African-American players were not allowed to play in America's, you know, national sport. And the issues of a separate league, and then the astonishing and dramatic and important issues that were raised when Jackie Robinson finally broke into the into the big leagues, is a terrific story that you might not necessarily know. I mean, we don't go looking for that. We look to tell the story of American history in the topic that we've, chosen for that film, and you just keep bumping into it. And it would be dishonest, I think, not to recognize that and not to show it. Lewis and Clark went across the United States, and Clark brought along York, who was his slave, who endured all of the hardships that they endured, came back and wanted his freedom and didn't get it for a number of years. And they also brought along, for part of the trip, Sacagawea, an Indian woman, who were both allowed at the mouth of the Columbia River to participate in a vote of where they were going to spend the winter.
Really?
That would be 60 years before African Americans were fully enfranchised in the United States, and 100 years before Native Americans and women were allowed the franchise. And so that we took, I think we played to that and brought that to the fore in ways that other histories of Lewis and Clark had not, because we saw in that this sort of throwing the rock out into the future that they represented, but also the shortcomings of how long it takes to get to that final moment when all people are created equal and considered so.
And that's one of the little gems that come up so often in these films. And race, for sure, is a theme that keeps coming up. Another thing I think that makes the films so fun, Dayton, is flawed heroes. The more you scratch into some of these great people of our nation who have done great things, the more you find out that they have all the same little problems that we all do. Just give us a couple of flawed heroes that really opened your eyes. Wow, I didn't know that about this person.
Well, I think, first of all, is that we used to, when I was growing up, actually, I'm this old, in a little town in Iowa, the way that American history was generally portrayed was this sort of triumphant march across the continent that began with the Pilgrims and brought us to the point we were. And there were heroes, and all heroes were spotless heroes. By the time that I was in college, times had changed, and there were no heroes. Everyone was a villain in the course of American history. What both Ken and I believe, and the people that work with us believe, is that a true understanding of history is to understand the people who made history. And they are just like you and me. And that means that they might have some great noble attributes, but they also have their flaws. Meriwether Lewis, who first attracted me to the Lewis and Clark story way back in the early 1980s, was sort of a hero of mine in the sense that of my sense of heroes. But he suffered from, we think, probably serious bouts of depression. He ended up committing suicide. Clark is a great hero, a great leader of men, a great geographer, self-taught, and an owner of a slave that he took with him to the continent edge and back, and when that person asked for his freedom, would not give it to him. I look at that in portraying that. It's not a way of just sort of trying to throw mud on the shoes of somebody who did something important, but just to try to help us all to understand this very basic notion. If only perfect people can be heroes, then there cannot be any heroes because there are no perfect people. On the other hand, if an imperfect person is capable of doing something heroic and historic, then maybe you and I are capable of that too. And so I find it actually hopeful.
Inspiring.
To portray our American icons or our important people in history with their warts and all. It's a terrific reminder and an important reminder to us that they are human. And because if we think of them in the separate sphere from us, then we are separating them from us, and we are not allowing us to perhaps partake in history.
We'll be back with more of my interview with Dayton Duncan right after this short break. I'm Laura Kanoy. You're listening to The Exchange on NHPR.
The Exchange on NHPR, where support comes from you, our members, and from Union of Concerned Scientists working to improve safety and security at America's 104 nuclear power reactors. Details at MakeNuclearSafer.com. From North Branch Construction Building Green for their clients and themselves project portfolio online at newly designed webpage northbranch.net. And the Silver Center for the Arts, Plymouth State University, presenting singer-songwriter Lucy Kapelansky on Friday, October 14th at 8 p.m. Tickets at silver.plymouth.edu. National Weather Service has issued a flash flood warning for Merrimack and Rockingham counties till about 11:40 this morning. For this morning, cloudy with some showers, heavy at times, highs today 58 to 63. Tonight, cloudy, showers ending, lows tonight 45 to 50 in most of the state, around 40 in the North Country. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today we're listening back to Dayton Duncan. The author and filmmaker was my guest at a live performance at the Colonial Theater in Keene on Friday. In his collaborations with Ken Burns, the two have produced some of the most popular documentaries of the last 20 years, from the Civil War to Lewis and Clark to the national parks. Before the break, I was talking to Dayton about some of the flawed heroes who we learn about through his films. I followed that up by asking him about the unsung heroes, those people who played large roles who seem to have faded into history.
Well, I mean, that's a great thrill when we're doing research on a film or a topic and we come across somebody that we haven't heard of or somebody that you might have heard a little bit about and you finally understand how significant they were in the story that you're trying to tell. In the national parks, we had quite a few of those. A fellow by the name of George Melendez Wright, who was a biologist for the Park Service, and somebody gave me a book about him, and I'm not a biologist. And I thought, oh, God, I don't want to read this. But it was a friend who sort of impressed it upon me, and so I started reading it. And I got intrigued by, first of all, he was a biologist but a great writer, which helps. But he was the person who helped change the course of National Park Service management practices to say, instead of killing the coyotes and the wolves and the hawks and even stomping the pelican eggs at Yellowstone because too many pelicans might interfere with the fishing, he's the one that tried to say what a national park is not just pretty scenery, but it's nature itself. And we need to recognize that and change our policies to do that. And one of the great things from our film, once it came out, were so many people who hadn't heard about him. It was also great that a number of people who were Hispanic who felt that they're unwelcome in parks or the parks really aren't part of their experience to see somebody named George Melendez Wright play such an important role in this important part of what our nation is that really made us feel good as well. We found the story of a wife and her husband, a couple from Lincoln, Nebraska, who traveled every summer to national parks. And I stumbled across this when I was working on yet a different film earlier. I was in Lincoln, Nebraska at the Nebraska Historical Society, and they had a little display of some photographs of some muddy roads. And I was working on Horatio's Drive about the first car trip across the United States. And I thought, hey, that photograph might work well in this film. So I asked the curator about it, and he said, well, this was a woman and her husband, and every summer they would take a trip, and she kept the diaries, and he took 5,000 photographs.
Wow, 5,000.
Yeah, and knowing that we were eventually going to be doing a national park film, I said, did they happen to ever go to any national parks? And he said, oh, yeah, they went to a lot of national parks. So these were diaries that had never been published, photographs that had never really been brought to light, and a character, a woman and her husband, whose love of the national parks brought to life by her words and his photographs, which stood in for all the other stories we couldn't tell about that, of how deeply important it was for them to go to the parks, what it meant to her spiritually, how obsessive they got after a while to make sure they went to every national park. All those things are truly American and were great to bring forward.
Well, and I want to let the audience know that Dayton Duncan visited all the national parks when he was putting together the film and was made an honorary park ranger for the effort. So
they gave me the hat.
The hat
is the most important thing. Diane, my wife, who's here tonight, would be the first to tell you that if I get grumpy around the house, she or the kids will go get the park ranger hat and bring it over and say, you need to put this on because when you're a park ranger, you can't be grumpy.
You know, I'm guessing, Dayton, that a lot of folks are just plain curious about how you and Ken Burns put these films together. But I want to back up a little bit more than that. How did you guys even start working together? And I know you get this question all the time, but how and why Walpole?
Well, I met Ken. I was the chief of staff for former governor, late Governor Hugh Gallon, back in the late 70s, early 80s. Ken had just moved to New Hampshire, to Walpole. And I had spent a lot of time here in the Monadnock region working for the Keene Sentinel, doing other things, and then went to Concord to work for Governor Gallon. And one of the freelance jobs that Ken had while he was trying to make his first film, to support himself so he could make his first film, was to interview the governor of New Hampshire, whoever that would be, for a piece for the BBC on the restoration of aging mill towns, which is an initiative that our administration had started. And so I met him. If he wanted to interview the governor of New Hampshire, he had to go through me. And back in those days, you know, people returned my phone calls back those times. And we struck up a conversation, and that led to we met a number of other times, and I went out of politics, back into writing, back into politics, back into writing, came back to the Monadnock region, and he and I became friends and realized as I was writing my books, he was working on our films, that just like the kids roll their eyes when you read the Declaration of Independence, the people sitting around our dinner table, as either of us was excitedly talking about this history thing that we were working on, that at least he and I were both interested in it. So we have a friendship that was based on a love of our nation's history and our nation and the ideals of it. Then I got him interested in some topics that I was interested in, and I sort of backed into writing and producing films as well as writing books.
And you've written many of the films that you have worked on.
What I tend to do, I have the best job in America because the ones that I write and produce are ones that are my idea in the first place, that are something that are either I'm curious about or I'm passionate about. So I like to describe what I do as a self-directed postgraduate degree in the topic of my choosing. And my job, with quotation marks, requires me to learn everything I can about that topic. If it was Mark Twain, I had to read everything that Mark Twain wrote and read things written about him. And my job required me to go meet the people who knew the most about him in his life. And my job as a producer required me to go with a film crews out to the places that were important to him, just as my job on national parks, quote, required me to go to all the national parks. And then put it all together in a script, and then work five houses from where I live in Walpole at our editing studio with an incredibly talented group of people to try to make this film as good as it can be, with one of my best friends as well, who happens to be the best filmmaker in America. Now, if anybody out here has got a better job than that, we can talk about it later, but that's as good as it gets.
Well, and part of the job, in quotes, is also to convince Ken, yes, this is a film that's going to work. How hard have you had to work sometimes to convince him that this is something we should put on television?
Well, we have sort of a large, as we call it, Florentine Films family, and there is no master plan per se. For us to make a film requires two things. Usually it's one of the people within that family to say they think this is a great idea and they really want to push for it to be made. And then the second element is Ken has to say yes. It requires both of those things. It particularly requires the second thing. I've had mixed successes. It took me 10 years to convince him that a film that I thought we should do on the first automobile trip across the United States, Horatio's Drive it eventually became, you know, had all the elements that we would want in terms of, if not significance, at least emblematic of something about the American spirit. And secondly, that we had enough material, the critical mass, we would call it, of photographs, letters or journals or newspaper articles to actually tell the story. And we'd be working on another project, and I keep needling him about the story, and I would be doing some research and give him a little bit more about it. They adopted a dog in Idaho, and that'd be great. And, you know, he got stuck all the time, and they broke down, and the other people were chasing and trying to beat him across. And he'd nod his head sort of patronizingly, and I could tell I wasn't selling him. And then we were working on the Mark Twain film, and my wife, Diane, who, like me, is a former reporter, took over the research, which is why things really changed, because she does a better job than I do. And she tracked down his granddaughters, Horatio Nelson Jackson's granddaughters, who happened to have the trove of letters that he had sent from the road to his wife that had never been published before, were unknown to the world, and both filled in the blanks of where he had been and what he had done, but brought to life his character, and we had Tom Hanks read his letters magnificently. And so finally, after 10 years of haggling and wheedling and him getting tired of being in a car with me, he finally said yes. National Parks took me 45 seconds.
45 seconds?
Yeah, about. I said, this is a story that begins in 1864 in the midst of the Civil War. So I know how to get his attention. I said, with the president named Abraham Lincoln, and it's the equivalent of the Declaration of Independence written by Thomas Jefferson, applied to the land, and he says, okay, let's do it.
I also want to remind you and our audience that we do welcome your questions now. Good evening. Thanks for coming out. Why don't you give us your name and where you're from, and go ahead.
My name is Kelly Franklin. I'm a fourth grade teacher in Massachusetts. And Mr. Duncan, I want to first start by thanking you for all of your work on the National Park series. It's unbelievable. And as a fourth grade teacher teaching social studies to our students, it's one of my most important roles to teach about our country. And I'm in the middle of teaching my National Park unit, which I was inspired by your series to do. And first of all, my students want to know today, they asked me to make sure I asked you what your favorite national park was. And second, if you could give our young students today one piece of advice, what might that be?
Excellent. Thank you so much.
Well, I'll start with the second one first, which is if it's dealing with national parks, what my advice would be is go visit a national park. I think we did a very nice job of telling the history and showing the glories of these treasures that belong to everybody in this audience and everybody who might be listening to this program and 290 million other people as well. I think we did a pretty good job of that. Be careful, my mother in heaven to be listening. I can't brag. But it doesn't compare at all to actually being there. So my first thing is to your fourth grade students is start doing what I did with Ken Burns on making Horatio's Drive. Get when they're in the car, start wheedling them of when are we going to go out and see some of these parks together. Their parents will be grateful when they do. It's one of the things that came through in the story that we told again and again and again is part of the glory of the national parks is not only their beauty and how awe-inspiring they can be, but being there with the people you love, particularly your family, is indescribable. I had the great luck when I was a kid growing up in Iowa, the only vacation that our family actually ever got to take was to national parks, Yellowstone and Grand Tetons and other places like that. When I took my children back to that 40-some years later, I could stand at a place that I could then remember the moment I stood there as a kid with my mom and my dad, and I could look down at my kids, and I could feel time moving forward, backward, every direction. And I could look forward to a time when they would be standing there with their children. And all of us, over those generations and back to generations long before that, and hopefully for generations untold, could see the same thing. And that is a very unusual place in this country where you can be that. So I'm sorry, I was preaching here. So get your parents and go to visit a national park. My favorite one is Glacier National Park. I don't want to say if there's some Grand Canyon people or Yellowstone people. I don't want to cause a fist fight because they're all great parks and they're all wonderful. And I used to tell people my favorite park is whatever park I'm in at the time, and that's also true. Glacier is my favorite because of what I just mentioned, of times that I was there with Diane before we had a family, of times that we've been there with our family, and the memories, imperishable memories that we made there.
Thank you so much for that question. It's hard to make films about wide-ranging topics like you do without having some folks who feel like you left this part of the story out. This part of the story is very important to me, and how could you not cover that part? How do you deal with that, Dayton, or how do you respond to that?
Well, you just do the best you can. When I write a script for one of our films, if each two-hour episode is about 40 pages. And in that 40 pages, depending on what we're covering, how great a span of time or whatever the complexities of the issue are, we also try to put you in that moment as much as possible. We want the people of that moment to speak for themselves through the letters that they wrote or the journals that they kept or the speeches that they gave or whatever. We want to give that as much space as we can to let it breathe and to do what Ken calls emotional archaeology on the history that they're telling. At the same time, it's 40 pages, and that's a longish magazine piece. So we don't begin this process thinking that whatever we are about to do is the definitive bit of history on that topic. Both Jeff Ward and I appreciate the fact that we often have companion books to it, and that allows us to put twice as much or more information back in. A lot of the great scenes that I've written, particularly, that fell on the cutting room floor can now be found in those books. But even those books are more popular history than the depth. We rely to such a tremendous extent on the incredible work that historians have done over time. That's where we begin. And what we hope is that our films are going to perk your interest and lead you back to those books so that you can learn more. Every film we do, if it was jazz, as I said, there were people who were aficionados of modern jazz, really ticked off that it didn't include that. Baseball, certain heroes. We grew up in Iowa. Bob Feller is a great guy there. Didn't get much, or other teams didn't get much. National parks, we spent 12 hours telling the history of the national parks, but it was over the course of 150 years of history. We couldn't tell the story of every single park. We couldn't even tell all the stories of a single park in that time. We have to pick the stories that we think that make sense to move the story along, that stand in for the stories that you're not telling, and you just do the best job that you can.
Let's take another person in our audience. Hi, thanks for being here.
My name is Gene Wojciechowski. I live in Richmond. I think I've seen all the films that you and Ken have made. My question has to do not with your next project, but the one after that. What will be the theme?
Well, when I said earlier we don't have a master plan, it'll sound like we do, because in 2 days, the film on Prohibition will be airing for 3 nights on public television, written by Jeff Ward and produced by Lynn Novick. After that, in 2013, is a film that was prompted by a book written by Ken's oldest daughter, Sarah Burns, on the Central Park jogger case, a woman who was brutally beaten and raped, and as it turned out, 5 young men were wrongly accused of it, and it follows that case. She's written a book about it, and she and Florentine Films are making a film on that, which will come out in 2013. In 2014 is a 7-episode, 14-hour film called The Roosevelts, An Intimate History, which follows the lives of Theodore Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt from the prism of the fact that they were all related to one another and are arguably 3 of the most important people in shaping the 20th century for the United States, if not the world. In 2015 will be a biography of Jackie Robinson. In 2016 is a major series on Vietnam, the war, and the war to end the war. And in 2018 will be the next one that I am writing and producing, which is, wait for it, country music.
That's uniquely
American.
And then
we'll take a breath. All right. And all of those have uniquely American aspects to them. We'll never run out of topics, if that's a worry.
More of my interview with Dayton Duncan right after a short break. I'm Laura Kanoy. You're listening to The Exchange on NHPR.
Today on Word of Mouth, a bloody contrarian. Steven Pinker's ongoing inquiry of human nature sets its sight on violence and how the brutal behavior of the past now horrifies us. And Andrew Bird, multi-instrumentalist, lyricist, and champion whistler. I'm Virginia Prescott. Whistle while you work with Word of Mouth, today at noon and again at 9 p.m. on NHPR.
More of our interview with Dayton Duncan coming up on The Exchange on NHPR at 10 o'clock. It's the Diane Rehm Show. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Grupone Auto Group. Featuring multiple lines of fuel-efficient, environmentally friendly cars at Grupone Auto Junction in Bow and online 24 hours a day at Grupone.com. And Penny Patou Travel, serving the needs of vacationers and business travelers of New Hampshire with offices in Laconia and North Conway. Information at PennyPatouTravel.com. New Hampshire Weather, National Weather Service has issued a flash flood warning for Merrimack and Rockingham counties till about 11:40 this morning. For this morning, cloudy, some showers, heavy at times, highs today 58 to 63. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today we're listening back to my interview with New Hampshire author and documentary filmmaker Dayton Duncan. I spoke with Duncan on Friday during a live event at the Colonial Theater in Keene, where we talked about his films and his long collaboration with Ken Burns. One of the things that makes their documentary so unique is how in-depth they are. Many have been 10 to 18 hours long. As we return to this performance, I asked if, in a world that seems to go faster and faster, Americans' attention spans can still hold up to these long-form documentaries.
We believe that you're selling the American people short if you think that their attention span is like 15 seconds or 60 seconds. I mean, obviously, Madison Avenue has done a good job of getting across by this, you know, aspire to this in that short of time. But in terms of learning something and experiencing something, I don't think the attention span is gone. And we criticize all the time that our pace is too slow, our films are too long. At the same time, as we just were talking about, we do a 12-hour series on the national parks, and people say, well, how come you didn't have my park? You know, why didn't you include this baseball hero in the 18 hours of baseball? So we very firmly believe in our filmmaking as we're sitting there and our incredibly talented group of editors start putting a scene together, that if you're just trying to bombard people with images, something is going on in their mind that takes it a little bit away from what you're hearing and detracts from the experience that you will have of actually listening to what Mark Twain had to say, listening to the journals of Lewis and Clark. And that if you are in a place that we have constructed for you with a photograph or with a beautiful shot of the Yosemite Falls, and you're listening to John Muir, you are with John Muir, who, when he is there and that experience that prompted him to write that was not 25 different images, it was an immersion in that. And we believe that it helps us in the storytelling that we're doing and in the recounting of it and in the memory of it. And we are storytellers, but we also believe in public television as an educational tool. And we're very proud of the way it is used, as someone mentioned, in their classes. And so in that educational moment, we want you to be there as much as you can. And that means maybe slowing down to the pace of our experience of life.
We have someone else at the microphone. Good evening. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. Good evening. My name is James Maynard, and I'm from Greenfield, New Hampshire. I'm a publisher who specializes in New Hampshire authors. And I'm curious, as an author, I realize this is more future casting than history, but how do you feel about how the ebook revolution and books on iPhones and iPads and such will change both books and society in general because of that?
On the one hand, I worry about it. I am old-fashioned. I want to hold a book in my hand. I like the opportunity to flip ahead or to flip back. And, you know, I've tried Kindle, and that doesn't work well for me in that respect. You know, how many more pages is there till I can go to the bathroom? The end of this chapter? You know, those kind of things. And I'm just old-fashioned and used to that. And the same way with us in making films with internet and all those things. It's a world that I have no idea how it's going to end up, except I do know this. I do feel that telling stories is so wired into us as a species that we will always need storytellers to help us understand ourselves and to just live as human beings. We began however many millions and hundreds of thousands of years ago telling each other stories around a campfire. That's how, if you think about your own life, it's not a random display of dates and names and things like that. It's a story. It's, I was born here, or I'll never forget the time that this happened, or this is an important thing to me. And that's the same way with our history. And if you look back into ancient times, long after we were just telling stories around a campfire, but finally writing them down, we tell it by stories. That's how we learn things. That's how we understand things. And I can't imagine that that desire and that need and that necessity will go away in any future, however ethereal and web-like, and I don't even have the right adjectives to, you know, to apply to it.
Someone else wants to ask a question to you, Dayton. Go ahead. Thanks for being here.
Hi, my name is Chris Marseille. I live here in Keene. And first, I'd like to thank you, Laura and NHPR, for coming to see us here at the Colonial Theater. This is a lot of fun. And thank you, too, Dayton. You mentioned earlier, Dayton, about how you're fascinated by how the geography of this country can inform and even influence who we are and where we're going. And I absolutely love the Lewis and Clark and understand it in that context. I wonder if there's any aspects of that idea that you can talk about, whether it's in more recent, we've experienced this massive immigration wave, we've experienced a migration to the coasts, or even if it is still from early American history. I'm fascinated by the combination of geography and history.
I think that part of our sense of who we are as Americans deals with our history as a people who saw this vast continent with its challenges, but also its great promise and the resources that it might have, that's seemingly unlimited, that is embedded in us even today. And it reflected in simply the fact of the suburbs is an expression of that same thing that led people to get into wagon trains and head to Oregon to a certain extent. Our sense of unlimited resources is still very present with us. And in saying that, now I realize that in this whole thing, I just forgot to mention that in 2012, we have a film on the Dust Bowl that I've written and produced.
Right.
So, I mean, and that is, too, again, a part and parcel of who we are as Americans, people going out and in a great speculative bubble. Does this sound familiar? Where they could buy land cheap and they thought the prices would always go up, and they started plowing up buffalo grass that had been growing there for the millennia, that had adapted itself to the changeable climate of the plains, and the changeable climate of the plains changed at a time they'd plowed the whole damn thing up, and they paid a horrible price for it. That's 70 years ago, but we're still doing the same thing as our film shows. They discovered that underneath this place, if they can't get rain, that there's the thing called the Ogallala Aquifer, and we'll just pump the water up if it's not coming from down. Well, that water took millions of years to form. It's left over from ice ages, and they're steadily depleting that. So our sense of what our ambitions are and our sense of how much elbow room we need, our sense of that we can do any damn thing that we wish, a lot of that comes from our relationship early on to this continent that just seemed unlimited without any boundaries, and that the things that it offered us were unlimited. And a myth that grew up that the settling of it was all done by individuals, when in truth, they're not to detract anything from the hardiness of the pioneers and all that, but equal to that history is the building of communities and working together and doing things. That's also part of who we are. So I think all that is still very much at play with us, and I don't see any sign of it at the moment of diminishing. Our sense of how we view immigrants is on a loop that repeats itself over and over and over again. You know, there was a time when if you spoke Norwegian, you know, you weren't necessarily welcome. There was a time when a big worry of many people in the United States was all the Catholic Irish people coming in. Then there was the great worry of the Eastern European Jews who were coming in. And, you know, our history is full of both this great expansion of open arm to welcome people from other countries, to provide them with freedom and opportunities that they couldn't find where they came from, and at the same time, many times, this panicked reaction by the people already here that somehow, you know, this time, these people are the danger to us. So history is helpful, I think, to understand a little bit of it, to put the present in context. And whether it's good for predicting the future is something that a future historian will tell us.
That's a great question. Thank you. Let's see if we can take one or two more. Go ahead, sir.
Hi, my name is Matt Young. And Laura, thank you and NHPR for some really insightful programming. Dayton, I served on a trail crew in Glacier National Park 6 summers ago, so Glacier is my all-time favorite as well.
All right.
Admit that for the record. And having seen quite a few of your films and a really unique take on storytelling, I'm also a student at Antioch University right here in town at the moment, and we're reading this really great book, The Courageous Follower by Ira Chalev. It has this whole idea of what is the role of the courageous follower and how leaders and followers, they should ideally orbit around a common purpose, according to Chalev. And talking about like flawed heroes and other kinds of heroes in your works and those that might be kind of overlooked at times, what do you think there might be the role of a courageous follower in your storytelling through documentaries and otherwise?
Oh, a courageous follower. I don't know if this fits in because I have not read the book. In our National Parks film, one of the heroes, if you will, if you want to call it that, one of the main characters was a guy named Stephen Mather, who was this charismatic businessman who decided to take on the cause of creating a National Park Service in 1915-1916. Spent his own money, was a promotional genius. He's the one that had come up with 20 Mule Team Borax to make borax, this very boring substance, a household necessity. Used those skills to create the National Park Service and to dramatically expand the national parks. Very rich fellow who, when he entered office in the Interior Department, was assigned this young guy named Horace Albright, who had arrived in Washington, D.C. so poor that he stayed in the YMCA, had only one suit, and had been sort of, you know, studying the bureaucracy as a clerk in the Interior Department. And under Stephen Mather, he started traveling with him and was inculcated with Mather's vision, if you will, and became the second. Mather also was a manic depressive and had certain times while he was Park Service director when he just disappeared for months at a time.
Wow.
And this young guy, Horace Albright, who was still in his 20s, was left to run this brand new agency called the National Park Service. He did it without letting people know what was going on with Mather, and eventually became as good, I would say, a director, as a second director of the National Park Service as Mather ever was. So again, without reading the book, I don't know if that fits into the role of courageous follower, but he was a guy who was the second in command, junior by not quite a generation, certainly separated dramatically by social caste, that became as important to Mather as Mather was to him.
Thanks for the question. I appreciate it. And, you know, Dayton, to wrap up with you, when you study these characters in history and you get to know them so well and you've done so many of these films, I wonder if you could just time travel and meet one person.
Oh, boy.
One person. That you've covered in all these wonderful historical films that you've done, who would it be?
Well, I won't. I will call it one person as the two people who became as one, Lewis and Clark. I would love to, if I only get this one shot at it, I would love to be transported back to be at a campsite with them and their expedition, to see for myself how these two men, who were similar in some respects, very different in others, how they actually interacted, to see how the core of discovery itself, what the sociology of a campsite would have been, you know, what were they talking about around the campfire, all these things that we don't get from their journals. Is really one of the big missing gaps of this story that, for me, is when Governor Gallen died and right after the 1982 election, I needed to get out of New Hampshire for my own sake. Maybe my own safety, I don't know. You'd have to talk to the governor that took his place to find out if they were after me or not. But I wanted to get away from New Hampshire, and having read one book of the journals of Lewis and Clark, decided that that's what I would do. And I feel lucky to this day that convinced an editor at the Boston Globe Sunday magazine that I should go out and find out what they would have discovered. And that trip led to my first book, Out West, which then sort of launched me into writing books, and which then, between friendship and other things, led into my making of films. So Lewis and Clark are part of my bloodstream, and I've written three books about them. I've done a PBS film and a shorter film for some other folks about them, and not a single year has gone by since 1983 that I have not gone out on the Lewis and Clark Trail somewhere. Somehow, I just got back from paddling 107 miles down the Missouri River in Montana. I have the calluses to show for it. So they, to me, are the ones that really are the spark for me of my interest in history, my interest in the American West, my renewal of being a writer, having been a reporter here at the Keene Sentinel and then going off into politics for a while. So they're my friends. I've never met them in person. I don't want you to think that I'm getting really weird here. I mean. But I would like to. I would like to be there and sit around a campfire and observe what that was like, because you don't get that in the journals.
Well, Dayton Duncan, thank you so much. It's been absolutely wonderful to talk to you.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thank you.
To hear the full broadcast of our event with Dayton Duncan, visit the Exchange page at nhpr.org. The Exchange on the Road was made possible with support from Citizens Bank. Today's broadcast was produced by the Exchange's executive producer, Keith Shields. And I'm Laura Kanoy. Thanks for joining us.